This edition of Culture with Robert Bounds was first broadcast on the 3rd of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 112th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. On today's show, we'll take a trip to South America to gauge the power of that great art magnet, Miami Basel, on the health and happiness of Latin America's art market.
There's something about the character of the Latin people that goes with the conversation.
We'll double up on movies, taking a look at a new documentary, Dirty Wars, that investigates America's penchant for covert conflicts. And we'll speak to François Ozon, director of the controversial new French film, Jean et Jolie.
I think it's important to forget your script and to create something new the day you are shooting with real person in the real situation.
Then we'll meet the man behind a festival in Hong Kong that aims to tie many of that city's multifarious strands together.
So many other events that happen in Hong Kong are either in convention centres or the institutions, and they're not things that are in our city's public spaces, and I think that's the real basis of this.
Plus a bit of a DIY music theme this week. We meet Kristin Hirsch, who's turned her back on the record industry as an entity, and we get treated to some electronic beats and homemade technology from Helsinki-based startup band Phantom for our Midori House session. So what better place to be today than here? It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. So kicking off the show first for us here on Culture, this week's session was a little shady. Well, actually, it was done in near total darkness. Phantom, aka Helsinki electronic duo Tommy Koskinen and Hanna Toivonen, don't just do live sets. They do live visuals too, with state-of-the-art projection technology, and mix their beats and sounds using homemade spaceship-like theremin machines. They're on the cusp of releasing their first record and were in London recently, so stop by to give us a taste of it. First of all, here they are with their latest single, Over. Hold it closer to the heart, so that you can see the dark. What is lost is gone. And what we That was Phantom with Ovo. Of course, we'll be hearing a little bit more from those cats later on in the show. So, Art Basel Miami opens this week, and one of the world's most established art fairs and an important source of inspiration for new American collectors and institutions. But the event also provides a lifeline for the thriving Latin American market and its artists, who often rely on overseas sales. Well, we wanted to catch up with one of the key players in this scene ahead of the event, so we sent our Buenos Aires correspondent, Ed Stocker, to meet one of Argentina's most feted contemporary artists, Eduardo Stupia, to find out what Art Basel Miami means for him.
Jorge Mara LaRouche Gallery in the Recoleta neighborhood of Buenos Aires. The gallery's star attraction is 62-year-old artist Eduardo Stupia. His works, using a variety of materials spanning ink, charcoal, and pencil, are wonderfully detailed abstract landscapes. Uruguay-born owner Jorge Mara shows Monaco around the minimalist exhibition space with its street-facing glass frontage. At the back is a slide door leading to an office space.
Well, this is our storage. It's where we keep the paintings. Let me show you some of Estupia's earlier work. I don't remember when I saw his work for the first time. Probably a mutual friend showed me his work. But in any case, I immediately was struck by the quality. I thought he was a wonderful artist, unlike any other of his generation.
The gallery, in its current location since 2001, will be attending Art Basel Miami Beach for the third time this year. Around 60% of sales come from overseas fairs, and Stupia's works sell for between around $10,000 and $30,000 US dollars.
We are showing the work of Sara Grillo. She was a very good artist, mainly from the 50s and 60s. Argentinian. She lived in New York at that time. Then Estupia. We have Carlos Arnaiz, who is another painter from the same generation as Estupia, who is also very good, very colorful. It's a different kind of work. I think he's going to be successful in Art Basel Miami. I also have another artist. I've been representing him. He is from Brazil. His name is Macaparana, and he is part of the tradition of very geometrical art in Brazil. That is also true in Argentina.
Time is ticking, and in Argentina, lunch is sacred. We jump in a taxi and head downtown to meet Stupia. Artist and curator, who have been working together since 2004, are good friends as well as colleagues, and often meet up in the week.
So we come down to Sotto Voce restaurant in the downtown area. I'm going to take this opportunity to ask how important Miami Beach is. So I'm going to start with Eduardo.
Even though I've been working in the art field from the last 4 years, I've only been going on to this kind of first in the last 3 or 4 years, you know? So for me, it's a real new thing and a very surprising thing. For me, it's also an opportunity to see how my work operates in a different field. I mean, because when you exhibit strictly in your hometown, you always have this kind of same response. So when you go abroad, you get a very different kind of responses, and it's a challenge, you know?
And how about you, Jorge? Tell me a bit about how you see the importance of the fair.
For us, for Argentinian galleries, it's extremely important because we can, you know, show our artists, expose us to so many people from the rest of Latin America, the collectors that come to Miami, and then the American public. There are a lot of collectors and institutions in Miami, and we sell a lot to them.
Our last stop is Eduardo Estupia's workshop. It's a beautiful, if a little dilapidated, townhouse dating from 1910, with creaking wooden floorboards, high ceilings, and mosaic tiles in the hallway. Located in the Almagro neighbourhood, the draftsman and painter rents three rooms here.
You've got a huge work on the floor that I didn't quite see straight away.
Yeah. Yes, it's pretty strange, you know, because I had to put it on the floor because I work it on the canvas itself without any kind of mounting. So I had to use the floor as a surface. It's like very, very rare.
Is this work going to Miami? Is this one of your
Yes, ones? This is one of the two large formats, large canvases that are going to Miami. I can show you the other one and a couple of new works in the other room if you want to show me.
Okay, let's go through our photo.
All right. Well, you see this guy, this is kind of a big hole in this.
And a cat.
Yes, and a cat. And a cat that comes with the building, you know? Here we are. Here we're entering to this third room. And then you can see here this second large canvas that I was telling you about. This is in black and white. The other one was like with little touches of color, which is a brand new thing for me also. But this is like a classic black and white with brush strokes, traces, textures, diagrams, fake typographical signs and everything. All this kind of stuff that I mixed together to do this kind of artificial landscape, you may say.
Tupia only found success late in life, something he puts down to a retrospective of his work in Buenos Aires back in 2006. Indeed, it's only recently that he's been able to give up working in the film and publishing world to concentrate on his first love full time. Part of it might have to do with his laid-back approach, which sees him walk round the stands and chat with punters at Art Basel Miami Beach, something most other galleries don't do.
I think it's very unusual for other galleries to have this artist speaking with the audience or with the viewer or the people. It's really very rare. I've never seen, with a couple of exceptions, I've never seen artists speaking with people at fairs. When I go to the fair, I really go around the fair all the time. I try to see all the fair completely. But I think that we are Latins. There's something about the character of the Latin people that goes with the conversation.
With Colombia and Peru joining Latin powerhouses such as Mexico and Brazil, never has there been more interest in art from the region. And the modest, gimmick-free Eduardo Tupia, enjoying the good hand that fate has dealt him, looks pretty unstoppable. For Monaco and Buenos Aires, I'm Ed Stocker.
Thanks, Ed. And Art Basel Miami Beach is on this week, and you can see Eduardo's work on display there at the Jorge Mara LaRouche booth. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Jeune et Jolie is the latest film from the French director François Ozon, whose prolific 15-year career has included highlights such as directing Les Belles du Cinéma Français in Eight Women, investigating how beauty, age and jealousy rub each other up the wrong way in Swimming Pool, and lampooned the comedic potboilers of 70s French cinema in Potiche. Jeune et Jolie explores what happens when a beautiful 17-year-old girl from a comfortable family becomes a hooker, seemingly just to see what it's like and gain a little or a lot of life experience. It's caused a stir in France, but I found it to be an even-handed and subtle look at the great power and loneliness of beauty, sex and teenagerdom. After watching the film before its UK release this week, I spoke to François about La Beauté et la Bête in Jeune et Jolie.
Ce que j'aimais, c'était prendre rendez-vous, discuter sur Internet, parler au téléphone, et puis y aller.
I met many young girls, many young French actresses, and many of them were very good. But when Marine arrived, it was something different because she was very good in the part. You believed in the situation with her, but she had something more than the others because she was very mysterious. And I had the feeling she was there in front of me, and at the same time she was somewhere else. So it was very intriguing, very mysterious. And for a director, it's very rare to find this kind of presence. So I decided to see her again. We had a meeting, we had a lunch together, we spoke a lot. And I had the feeling she could be very good in the part because she was she had a quality star, a real quality star. And I think for such a part, you need this kind of actress.
She seems very strong. She's very young, obviously, in the part, but she seems very strong as well. Were there two elements that you wanted to find in your leading actress?
Yes, it was important because I'm not, my film can be perverse, but I am not perverse in work. You know, I like to work in good relationship with the actors. And it's important for me, especially when I work with young actors, that they can feel comfortable on the set. And Marine, the first thing I asked her was, are you afraid to be naked, to have sex scenes? And she said, no, if I trust you, if it's important for the part, I can do it. And I had the real sensation she was strong enough to carry such a part, because we had lot of conversation. I spoke to her, you know, an actress like Catherine Deneuve, after Belle de Jour, it was very hard for her to cope such a part. Or Charlotte Rampling after Portier de Nuit, the film by Liliana Cavani, it was very hard too. So we had many conversations, and I think she's very mature for her age. And I think it was important for me to have someone strong like her.
You've written and directed Jeune et Jolie. So you're the singer and the songwriter. They're two different sides of your brain that do that, those two different jobs, François.
For me, the writing is just a way to communicate, to put on the paper all what I want. But what I like when I'm shooting is to recreate everything. And I don't follow always the script, you know. Sometimes I think it's important to forget your script and to create something new the day you are shooting with real person in the real situation, with a real set. I think it's at this moment that the creation really is important for me. The writing is just a process, but it's not the goal.
The film is in four parts, in four seasons, in fact, and these are sort of framed by Françoise Hardy songs. Did that sort of help give you structure?
I think when you are a teenager, when you are at school, you have the feeling a year is so long. You know, time is different. When you are an adult, you have the feeling everything goes so fast. But when you are young, you have the feeling everything is long. The seasons are very important. So I thought it could be interesting because I didn't want to make a psychological movie with explanation, to have four different moments in the film, as I did in a film before, Five Times Two. You know, it was about five moments of the life of a couple. In the case of this film, I wanted to have four seasons and to show the girl at four different moments in four different moods. So after, the songs of Françoise Hardy came to give a feeling for each season.
Votre film, elle a une double vie, madame.
La police est venue. Je sais tout.
And there's a sense in Marine, in our character, that she's very independent. She doesn't spend any of her money, right? Was this an important thing, that it was about exploration rather than any necessity?
Yes, it would have been too easy to say she has no money, that's why she does that. I wanted something more mysterious and something more disturbing, because this girl is beautiful, she lives in a rich family, she has no problems. Why does she do such a behavior? That's what interested me. So it was important, it was just a need she has in herself, and it's up to the audience to try to understand why she does that.
And I wondered if you think there's a terrible loneliness in great beauty.
Yes, I think so. It's funny you say that, because I spoke with many psychanalysts, I don't know if you say that, psychanalysts in France, and many of them were very interested in the film, and one of them, a Lacanian, said to me, very often, very beautiful women have this fantasy to be masochist, but to become dirty, I don't know what is the word, to être sali in French. I don't know how you say that in English. Like in Belle de Jour, you know, a beautiful woman like Catherine Deneuve want to go with men who are not beautiful and of another social condition.
Vous avez l'intention de continuer? C'était une expérience comme ça.
That was François Ozon, director of Jeune et Jolie, out this week in the UK. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back next with Christine Hirsch.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. It's 10 years since Throwing Muses last released an album, and between the late 80s and mid-90s especially, the Rhode Island-based band created a canon of curious, barely comparable left-field rock and roll, which had an immense and resonant influence on artists including Nirvana, Pixies, R.E.M. and PJ Harvey, among many others. Throwing Muses songwriter Christine Hirsch has not been idle in that decade, releasing albums under her own name and with the band 50 Foot Wave, and writing a well-received memoir, Rat Girl. Throwing Muses are now back, and their new album, Purgatory/Paradise, is both a record and a book, each track accompanied by a Hirsch essay reflecting on the writing of the songs and other things besides. It's also funded by their fan base, and Christine Hirsch came to Midori House to explain all to Andrew Miller.
I started before Kickstarter. I'm not sure we're all going to the right places. I'm not sure we've escaped that problem of trust funders being the only ones who can afford to be musicians, and we do not need their soundtracks in our lives.
There's increasingly a similar problem with journalism,
yes.
Funnily enough.
And photography, and yeah, just about everything. So it's more a matter of, are you going to manifest your heaven and deal with it? Or, you know, are you going to lie like everybody always has done? And lying was boring. It's even more boring now. So you might as well make your mess and even be willing to walk away. Now more than ever, it's not, success isn't the number of people paying attention. It's the success of your product.
The new album, Purgatory/Paradise, it's sort of a book as well as an album. There's essays attached to each of the 32 tracks on it. One of the essays does talk about your music reaching what I think you call the right ears. Have you figured out yet who your audience are, do you think?
My new spiel is, it's not for everyone. After saying, you know what, you can deal with this. It's not that weird. For so many years, I realized not everyone is fluent in the music language. and that's part of why I wrote these essays to accompany them. It's not dancing about architecture as much as it is just sitting next to a song in its atmosphere and saying, hey, there's this story, and there's this texture, and there's this light and shadow, and there's this thematic current of color, and then Dave would reflect it in the artwork. And the best way to present the attraction of that kind of keyhole view into our goofy little universe is to say, you probably won't like it. It's incredibly effective. People just jump on the bandwagon. Like, yes, I will. I get it.
The passive-aggressive approach to marketing.
Exactly.
There was one of the essays, I think the one attached to Mourning Birds, where you talk about the relationship that you now have with your songs, where you say, I take it lying down and then the songs stand up and act like a dickhead for me, and it's an arrangement that works for all of us. Has that always been the case with the songs, do you think?
It has always been the case. This year, it changed. I was treated for PTSD, which had caused a schism in my personality, literally a split personality. So one of me was music and trauma, and the other was the cerebral person that sat in the room and was nice. And after the treatment, the two personalities merged, and so I don't know how it's gonna work. I don't even know if I can work anymore, actually, because what I do is very intense, and I was always able to compartmentalize it. You see me on stage, I disappear. That's the other personality, that's the music personality. So I had no memory of her writing songs. I took no responsibility for the songs she wrote, and I could live, you know, without pain. So I don't know what's going to happen now.
The essays on the album have a diary style quality to them. There's a lot of snapshots from real life and road stories, of which you must have quite a collection now, having been a touring musician for, it must be,
don't count.
Okay,
for it must be many, many years.
For quite a while.
Since 1908.
But are you? Is there a concern at all about, I guess, whether there was a concern with Rat Girl as well, maybe, about letting light in on magic, as it were? I mean, I love the story attached to Terra Nova, I think, about you all standing on a highway next to a broken down van in the middle of nowhere. And I mean, I've been on tour with enough bands to know that it's usually more like that than it is what people imagine it's going to be like. But do you think for some people it's important to imagine that the whole thing is incredibly glamorous and exciting, though?
No, I think the other is important. I always wanted to be their plumber, their electrician, and that's part of why I took myself out of the world of the tour bus to the stage, to the tour bus to the hotel room where you don't see the people you're playing for. You know, obviously, I wasn't a rock star, never wanted to be, and nobody ever should have been. And so we need to say, well, this is a job, and you should pay me, like, you know, maybe $5, whatever you think is fair, and stop calling it anything else, because once you don't reach a status that looks shiny to other people, they'll call you a failure, no matter how great your music is. And that's not respecting music, it's respecting money and marketing.
It's always struck me as really a strange definition of success in music. But you're right, that is how things are measured, in how many records or tickets you sold.
Yeah, who's paying attention? And we all know that they're paying attention to the crap. So the math really doesn't work.
The title of the album, and this is possibly an obvious question following on from that, Purgatory slash Paradise, is that in any sense a reflection of how you feel about what you do for a living?
It could be. It was the right title. Soon we'll figure out why. But really, it's the two streets that our favorite beach is on, where when we're done recording, we just go sort of crash at the beach or jump in the water, and it washes off all the mistakes we made that day. And it's right between Purgatory Road and Paradise Ave.
That's no way to let a body down.
That was Christine Hirsch talking to Andrew Muller, and Throwing Muse's new album, Purgatory Paradise, is out now. It's not over yet, because still coming up in the show, we'll hear the story behind session guests Phantom's ultrasonic frequency controller, also known as the UFO. We'll meet investigative reporter Jeremy Scarhill, whose uncovering of the dark corners of America's military strategy has just been made into a film. And we'll find out how the streets of Hong Kong will shortly be alive with art, music and film. So back to this week's Midori House session, which today is coming courtesy of Phantom. As the media stumbles to find a new way to say catchy pop music, the tag being bandied about for these two is startup band, due to both members being somewhat tech-savvy entrepreneurs. Tommy from the band even makes his own instruments, and their recent session at Midori House was enhanced no end by his homemade MIDI theremin, a flying saucer-like disc that emits wobbly sci-fi frequencies when in contact with the odd jazz hand or two. The Monocle's Tom Hall sat down with Hannah and Tommy afterwards to find out more. But first up, here they are with Kisses.
If you don't like my kisses, honey, here's what I will do. I'll go and see a girl in purple and kiss the sidewalk to the loo. If you don't want my loving, honey, should I take up all this space? I'll get out of this whole planet. Let some sweet baby have my place. If you don't want my loving, honey, why should I take up all this space? I'll get out of this whole planet. Let some sweet baby have my place. If you don't want my loving, honey, why should I take up all the space? I'll get out of this old planet. Let some sweet baby have my place.
always felt I've been doing a lot of electronic music live shows before Phantom as well, and there was this need of having some kind of direct communication with the audience, and it doesn't translate very well if you have a MIDI controller box and you're just tweaking the knobs and staring at the laptop screen. Instead, what I wanted to have is a really, really physical way of performing, and I think this translates it quite well, so I can control huge arrays of sounds by just moving my hands above the device.
There's a term that's been put a lot with you as a startup band.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
And it kind of sounds like it's almost like a business project, which is actually really interesting. But I just wondered how true that is. Where is that coming from?
Well, I mean, both of us we're musicians and we've worked in the startup scene, yes, as musicians, and that's how we met. And we've worked with kind of like music innovations and music technology and the kind of new business models, whatever, in the music industry. And I've been also researching that in my university. Yeah, of course, we have been involved in the startup scene, and we're really happy to know all those really, really like intelligent and talented people who have really cool ideas. And that's helped us a lot forward.
Do you think that to be a band today, it's almost a necessity to have that slight bit of kind of business news to what you're doing, because we're told constantly that you can't rely on labels anymore. You have to do everything DIY yourself. Do you think pretty much every band should be thinking a little bit sort of business-wise about what they're doing?
Probably.
Yeah,
really
definitely.
Helps. It really
yeah,
helps.
I think so. I mean, of course, you have to think about the labels. And I mean, no one has money right now, it kind of seems so. Except some few people. But of course, I mean, the more you can do yourself. I mean, the label is only there for some stuff, but still, even with a label, you have to be creative and, you know, find ways to put yourself forward. They're not going to be like a god who will bring you to success, I mean.
No, no. And what's next for Phantom? What's on the horizon for you guys? Have you got plans to record more or tour more? What's going on there?
We've been working on the album for a while now, so that's the project now, to make an entry for it. And then, I mean, hope we can have a great tour. And we haven't settled a tour yet, but I mean, of course, when the album comes out and so on.
That was Phantom, a.k.a. Tommy Koskinen and Hanna Toivonen, speaking there to Tom Hall. The band have just finished a huge tour and will be releasing their album in the new year. WeAreFantom.com has all the information. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's a film about America's secret wars across the globe, targeted attacks from Yemen to Somalia via Afghanistan. More specifically, it's a documentary about the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, the powerful group that took out bin Laden in 2011. Directed by cinematographer extraordinaire Rick Rowley, Dirty Wars follows investigative reporter Jeremy Scarhill as he tracks a military force that operated in the shadows until the killing of the head of Al-Qaeda. With a book and this film, Scarhill tells the story of civilian populations that have become the victims of targeted killings and asked the US government to accept responsibility. Scarhill stopped by Midori House last week to discuss the film with Monocle's Daphne Denis.
It's hard to say when this story began.
Greetings from Kabul, Afghanistan.
This was supposed to be the front line in the war on terror.
What's the name of this village out here?
But I knew I was missing the story. There was another war hidden in the shadows.
The film is not an adaptation of the book, and the book is not meant to be just the companion to the film. The film is about an investigation that became a book. And what we tried to do with the film is to make a 90-minute journey accessible to people. And that's, you know, a bit of a challenge, but we were trying to tell human stories and to do it in a way that the average person could absorb the information without feeling like they're in a university classroom or they're being just bombarded with a catalog of horrifying images, but actually tells a story and tries to capture a moment in time.
It's a documentary, but it very much looks like a feature film. It's a feature film that's kind of narrated in the first person about real facts. And obviously there's a huge cinematography effort behind it, to the point that it almost feels like it's a feature film that I'm watching when I'm watching it. How did you construct that? And obviously you did this on purpose. Why?
Well, the director of our film, Rick Rowley, he and I have known each other for, I don't know, 12 or 13 years. I worked with his wife for many years in Baghdad. She's also a filmmaker. And Rick actually is like a combat journalist, and he doesn't have any real formal training as a filmmaker, but he's an incredibly creative guy. And I think that if you were to look at the body of his work, his journalism always has the feel of something bigger than just a straight documentary. His reports from Iraq in the early stages of the war, where he was trying to humanize the Iraqi people who were on the other end of the occupation, you didn't feel like you were watching journalism. You felt like you were watching an incredibly moving story. And so a lot of it is due to the eye of Rick Rowley, the director. But we did talk about style, and we wanted to embrace aspects of various genres that would be familiar to people and to try to push the envelope.
Let's talk now about the narration of it. You've written that story in the first person. You narrated it in the first person, which is unusual for a journalist. I mean, I think we've all
It's unusual for me, too, just in general in life. I don't write articles about myself. Yeah.
So, I mean, it must have been difficult. And I think some people have been quite critical of it, sort of saying that you've put yourself in the center of the story, that is a story about other people, that is a story about Afghanistan, about Yemen, about Somalia, as we were saying. So how did it feel for you to make that choice? And was it a difficult choice to make?
Yeah, it was really painful. In fact, I resisted it for a long time. And I mean, I also think that, you know, yes, this is our film, but I'm self-critical. And I think that there is a legitimate critique of the film that has to do with the way that we chose to tell the story. I mean, I'm very sensitive to, you know, the fact that there is a sort of trope where, you know, the sort of white Western savior comes in to tell you how things are in the land of people of color. And I think it's a totally legitimate critique. The issue was not like, I want to be in this film. I didn't want to be in the film. The issue is, how do we tell this story in a way that it's going to resonate with people? So, you know, we didn't make a perfect film. And I question that to this day. I have trouble sitting through. I can't watch it at screenings because I don't like to see myself on the screen and I feel embarrassed about it. But while I'm embarrassed about that, I'm very proud of the journalistic work that we did.
I got a strange phone call. Someone from the inside was reaching out to me. Someone close to the heart of the president's elite force.
There are hundreds of covert operations on multiple continents with the full support of the White House.
You've been often described as an activist, and some people have criticized you for how outspoken you've been against the US government, or at least against those operations that you've uncovered. Do you think that there's a contradiction or some truth to what has been said about you?
Yeah, I think it's funny because the notion of objectivity or impartiality that, you know, you're told you need to have as a journalist is a completely farcical, nonsensical entity. It doesn't exist. And some of the fiercest activists in media work for major corporate news outlets, and they have a slavish devotion to defending the narrative of the state. And so, I mean, I think they're far more passionate activists than any of us in terms of their devotion to the official story. I think journalists should have an inherently adversarial relationship with the state, and that's part of the public service. That's in our country, that's why our profession is the only one written into our Constitution, is because when all three branches of our government collude against the interests of the people, the journalists are the ones that are supposed to be the check and balance against it. So, you know, I don't think activist is a bad term. I think some of the best people in society are activists, and we need them. It's just when it's used to sort of say, well, you're not a real journalist. You know, I would challenge someone on, you know, tell me where I've gotten my facts wrong. Yeah, I do believe in my stories. And I also believe in advocating for victims of injustice, particularly when the injustice was meted out against them by the government of the country where I come from. I believe that's part of being a journalist. So if someone wants to point out where I was inaccurate or my facts weren't straight, I'll debate them on that any day. But to go after me because I actually care about the people I'm reporting on, I mean, I take that as a compliment, not an insult.
In your film, you reveal that an American citizen has been targeted by the US government. Do you think that's one of the things that the American public is going to care the most about?
It already has happened. I mean, you know, this story of this guy, Anwar al-Awlaki, I mean, I was on this story even before he was killed. We knew that he had been put on this kill list. Word leaked out about it. And I started investigating who he was and sort of what the U.S. government was doing to try to pursue him. The idea that the president of the United States believes that he has the authority to assassinate a U.S. citizen who has not been charged with a crime and is not on an active battlefield is deeply offensive, I think, to a majority of Americans. The problem is, though, that I think that if Anwar al-Awlaki's name was Jimmy Smith, I think that a lot more people would pay attention to it. I think there's a serious racism in how we view the other. And, you know, I think that because there's a perception that the terrorists are Muslims or are Arabs or are Pakistanis, I think a lot of white Americans don't care. But if the people being targeted were, you know, white people, with Anglo-Saxon names, I think we'd be having a very different discussion. So part of why I try to humanize people that were told are the enemy is to push back against that sort of cultural imperialism that I think permeates our media culture in the U.S.
America knows war. They are war masters.
That was investigative reporter Jeremy Skyhill speaking to Daphne Denis, and Dirty Wars is out in UK cinemas now. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to Hong Kong after this. Go nowhere.
The Arctic has inspired artists for centuries with tales of adventure and exploration. Monocle Films made its own expedition to Denmark to see the Louisiana Museum's Arctic exhibition to seek out the past and the present of this mythic place.
As nations are vying for the north, negotiating trade routes and expanding development, and the Arctic landscape threatens to disappear, this exhibition takes a visionary stance that activates dialogue on every level, from science to pop culture.
Arctic Inspiration, premiering in the film section on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, and we're finishing the show today with a trip to Honkers. Kicking off this coming weekend in the city is the Very Hong Kong Festival, a new multidisciplinary event covering art, music and design. The aim is to energise the public spaces of Hong Kong, generating a New York or London-like buzz and staging an event which everyone living in the metropolis can enjoy. Well, earlier this year, Very Hong Kong Festival co-founder Cassius Taylor-Smith was in London and he stopped by to tell me more.
It's really a new public festival for Hong Kong on a series of public events in public spaces in the city, and something that was very different for Hong Kong, really bringing it, I think, in line with international events that happen, whether it's here in London, in Sydney, New York, and really giving the city something to celebrate, for the people to come together. It's a really community-focused event. It's an arts, design and culture event for Hong Kong. We have obviously a whole host of great art events that now happen in Hong Kong, but they're really in the commercial sector and very difficult for people to access, whether it's...
Well, Art Basel, I guess, is the latest thing. It used to be the Hong Kong Art Fair. That's a big thing, but again, it's kind of it's an elitist thing, I guess, to get into that.
Yeah, it's not something that the public can get involved in. And actually, so many other events that happen in Hong Kong are either in convention centres or the institutions, and they're not things that are in our city's public spaces. And I think that's the real basis of this, to bring street life back to the fore in Hong Kong and celebrate culture.
And this is a big thing, because when I used to know Hong Kong quite well when I was a kid and when I was a teenager, and it's changed a lot. There seems to be less accessible public space, right? Because there's a lot of buildings where there used to be cul-de-sacs. There's a lot of where there used to be a two-story building, now there's a sort of 222-story building. So I guess it's reclaiming the streets a little, reclaiming some of the space and using it in a creative way.
Absolutely. Right? It's getting people to remember how to use the streets and how to use public space. I mean, we're a city that's going through a lot of urban regeneration. I mean, there are two massive projects. There's the West Kowloon Cultural District and the regeneration of Kowloon East, which was the former industrial district by the old airport. And you know, there is a natural tendency for those to be very commercially driven, I mean, East Kowloon in particular, to provide space for business. But we need to find space for culture to happen in the city as well, in these spaces. And this, as a festival which is going to be concentrating on Kowloon East as one event hub, and also on the Hong Kong Island side, where we have great waterfront promenade, which is just being built, and we've got lots of pocket parks and places that people kind of have forgotten that they can use, and they can put things on there, and they can, you know, come together as a group.
How do you kind of control all the different skeins that are going to be running through this festival? You could describe it as an arts, design
and culture festival.
Yeah, and that's a very big umbrella you're holding up there, Cassius. What on earth comes underneath that umbrella?
Well, we as a festival foundation are organising a series of events that try and touch upon a number of these. So we've got a music festival and also public arts installations in the city, you know, sculptures in the streets, and then a series of street events that are focusing on emerging designers in fashion. So we have a street fashion catwalk. We'll have food events as well with pop-up restaurants. So we're organising these series of kind of major installations in the city. And then the other core part is going to be a collaborative event programme. So we're setting out a brief for public groups, for NGOs, And also, you know, private individuals and private companies to generate their own ideas to put into this festival for things that they want to see happen in the city. So with that, we're aiming to get about 100 events over the course of 9 days. In all these spaces.
It's going to be pretty busy.
Yeah.
Okay. You're going to be one of those organisers that has at least sort of 4 Blackberries or whatever, right? I wanted to ask you about Hong Kong as a place of culture itself. Mm. Obviously, its history is one of... It's got such a multifarious history as like a tax haven, as like a spoil of the Opium Wars, all the rest of it. It's clearly a big financial centre. It's an amazing business centre. Yeah. But it's not famous for being a cultural centre. Is it going to be a mix, your festival, of indigenous Chinese, Cantonese and Hong Kong kind of culture, as well as importing some stuff from mainland China and I guess the rest of the
Absolutely.
World?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a city that's always been very cosmopolitan in its makeup, and that's part of our response with the festival, trying to create something which reflects that cosmopolitan nature. We have, as you know, mentioned earlier, we've got a growing range of good events, whether it's Art Basel, whether it's all the new galleries that have opened up there, yeah. which has really taken the art scene up by a level. And then we've got the arrival of things like West Kowloon. But I remember when I first arrived in Hong Kong, I felt there was a bit of a dearth of good quality culture and art to access for the public.
And accessible stuff as well. Like, where do you go and see a band in Hong Kong? This is the kind of thing, do you know what I mean? This is the kind of thing, you need some stuff where you can, you need to, there aren't enough queues around the block in Hong Kong, I always find. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the thing that you kind of want to see. There doesn't seem enough doorways where you go, oh, I wonder what that is. Yeah. It kind of maybe it used to be like that, but it was probably just an amazing restaurant that had great lobster or something back in those days, right? But you need that thing. You do need a real street level thing, don't you?
You do. I mean, and there is a great level of change that's happening. And I think, from the public sector, they're supporting creative industries. They're really trying to get Hong Kong as a centre for that globally in comparison to London and Singapore, and really trying to support that sort of native industry, which is happening. And actually, that's what we're trying to pull out of quiet corners of Hong Kong and bring them into the street, because there's lots of stuff that is happening, but it's just not in the mainstream. Uh-huh. And they're not on a regular programme for people to find out about.
That was Cassius Taylor-Smith talking about Very Hong Kong Festival, which kicks off in the city this coming weekend. For more information, just visit veryhk.org. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. I'm very excited about next week. No, it's not Art Basel Miami Beach again. We've decided to dedicate a whole edition of the Culture Show to the fascinating world of the tribute band. So lots to look forward to there. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bowden. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher put in a bit of elbow too. Time for one final track this week from their Midori House session. This is Phantom with Voices. Thanks for tuning in.